through this, and this is the first time, no, it's not really the first time that I've shared it publicly, but in our church, where we go to church, where we're members, the last couple Sabbaths, I did share this in an abbreviated form. But with them, I did not take the time to make any connection with Daniel 11 because I didn't have the time, and I want to try to make a connection here, so I'm going to go through it a little bit slower, and I'll give you a heads up. I'll give you a heads up on what it is, and we'll have to go through it piece by piece. And it's the longest time prophecy in the Bible that I know of. Well, it's 25:20. And if you were here this weekend, there was a point where we read from Early Writings, page 74, where Sister White states that she saw that the 1843 chart was directed by the hand of the Lord and that the figures should not be altered. And she also said that she saw that the Lord's hand was over some of the figures. So what does that mean? Now, generally, maybe you're familiar with this, but generally, here at the end of the world, we in Adventism, when someone says 25:20, we don't know anything about it. But I, without even getting into it in depth right now, I want to at least point out to you that here on the 1843 chart that Sister White was speaking about, this time prophecy right here of 25:20, which William Miller believes started in the year 677 and concluded in 1843, that was part of what the Millerites were understanding and teaching. Now, shortly after the disappointment, Hiram Edson put together a series of articles that he never concluded, where he corrected the starting point for that prophecy. But in Adventism, by that time, for whatever reason, I certainly don't know why, in Adventism, we never seem to pursue it any further. But you can find that starting point was corrected. It was not 677. Now, if you remember, Israel, the 12 tribes of Israel were divided into the 10 northern tribes and the 2 southern tribes, and God related to them as the northern and southern kingdom. And they were destined to go into captivity because they would not keep the covenant. God promised that if they wouldn't keep the covenant, he was going to bring punishment upon them. And and he did so, but he took the northern kingdom into captivity first, whereas the southern kingdom was taken into captivity in the year 677. So William Miller, when he dealt with this 2520-year time prophecy, he chose the date that the southern kingdom was taken into captivity. But in reality, this indignation of the Lord that was brought against Israel began when they were first taken into captivity. Now, William Miller, no doubt, was tempted to take that position, because when you put the 2520 on 677, then you come to the very year that he was seeing everything fulfilled in 1843. But if you take the date when Assyria came and took the northern kingdom into captivity, there is a much more profound understanding in that time prophecy. So what is the significance of that here at the end of the world? I'm just giving you an overview. We're going to have to deal with that in depth. Let me see if I can give you a quote, if I can turn right to it. Relax. I'm not going to really bury you on this right off the bat. We're going to go into it slowly. How many of you have considered the 25:20 before? Okay. Trust me, once it's not that hard, and once you see it, you'll say, well, this was worth understanding. I think everyone we've shared it with before has thought, hey, this is worth understanding. But here's my point. How does this connect with Daniel 11? I need to at least set it in context for that before we begin. There is what I believe the most important passage in the spirit of prophecy on Daniel 11. It's found in manuscript releases number 13, page 394. We read one the other day from Testimonies, Volume 9, where Sister White's clearly describing our time period. It's the passage that starts on page 11, where she says the final movements will be rapid ones. And then a little bit later on, she says the prophecy in the 11th chapter of Daniel has nearly reached its complete fulfillment. And we emphasized when we were reading that, and when Sister White is explaining the characteristics of our day and age, the passage in the Bible that she points to is Daniel 11. We were making that point. So that is an important inspired reference from Sister White on the importance of Daniel 11. But this one that we're going to read here, in my mind, is much more important. And when those people that begin to grapple with the last six verses of Daniel 11 and they come up with, you know, different ideas, in the controversy may go forward on what those verses need, if they're going to be serious about it, they have to address this passage. And the reason for it is there's a paragraph that leads into a passage of verses, where in the paragraph, Sister White emphasizes that when Daniel 11 is fulfilled, there will be a repeat of the histories that have already taken place in Daniel 11. And then she quotes six verses in Daniel 11. And as soon as she quotes those six verses, she says, scenes similar to those described in these words will take place. Now, my point is this. She's talking about the future fulfillment of Daniel 11. If you turn to Daniel 11, just briefly, we've made this point a couple times this weekend already, but in Daniel 11, verse 40, it says, "And at the time of the end shall the king of the south push at him." Now, the subject leading into verse 40 is the king of the north. So when it says, "At the time of the end, the king of the south shall push at him," this word push is a Hebrew word that means to war against. If you turn back to chapter 8, verse, where we see the ram pushing against him, chapter 8, 4. I was reading 4, but wasn't. Oh, it's right at the beginning. In verse 4, it says, "I saw the ram pushing westward and northward and southward." This word "pushing" is the same Hebrew word as "push" here in verse 40. And as Adventists, we've identified this word "pushing" as war. This is a warfare, describing warfare. So in verse 40, it says, "In the time of the end, the king of the south is going to begin a war against the king of the north, and in great controversy." Page 356, Sister White defines 1798 as the time of the end. Now, the point I'm trying to make here is that when Sister White's speaking about the future fulfillment of Daniel 11, she's speaking about history that takes place after 1798. She receives her first vision in December of 1844, right? So if she's going to talk about the future fulfillment of Daniel 11, she's talking about the part of Daniel 11 that's going to come to pass at least after 1844. So the time of the end here in verse 40, she's not talking about that. Now I'm submitting to you that verse 40 is still future of her day and age, but for sure the first 39 verses of Daniel 11 are past tense to Sister White. So if she's talking about the future fulfillment of Daniel 11, she's speaking about the last six verses of Daniel 11. And she's going to in this quote. Here's the quote. Now, if you turn to verse 30 and 31 of Daniel 11, I'll read Sister White's writing, and then she's going to quote verses 30. She's going to cut in to verse 30. she cuts in where she says, where in verse 30 it says, "For the ships of Chittim shall come against him, therefore he shall be grieved." She starts with the words, "He shall be grieved." And she quotes verse 31, 32 through 36. And then she comments when she's done. You'll see what I mean here, I hope. We have no time to lose. Troublous times are before us. The world is stirred with the spirit of war. Soon the scenes of trouble spoken of in the prophecies will take place. The prophecy in the 11th of Daniel has nearly reached its complete fulfillment. Much of the history that has taken place in the fulfillment of this prophecy will be repeated. You see, much of the history that's taken place in the first 39 verses of Daniel 11 is going to be repeated. Okay, by context, that's what she's saying. But then she continues on. In the 30th verse, a power is spoken of, and here's where she cuts in, that shall be grieved and return and have indignation against the Holy Covenant. So shall he do. He shall even return and have intelligence with them that forsake the Holy Covenant. And arms shall stand on his part. And they shall pollute the sanctuary of strength, and shall take away the daily sacrifice, and they shall place the abomination that maketh desolate. And such as do wickedly against the covenant shall he corrupt by flatteries. But the people that do know their God shall be strong and do exploits. And they that understand among the people shall instruct many, yet they shall fall by the sword, and by flame, by captivity, and by spoil many days. Now when they shall fall, they shall be holpen with a little help, but when many shall cleave to them with flatteries, and some of them of understanding shall fall to try them, and to purge, and to make them white, even to the time of the end, because it is yet for a time appointed. And the king shall do according to his will, and he shall exalt himself, and magnify himself above every god, and shall speak marvelous things against the God of gods, and shall prosper till the indignation be accomplished, for that is determined shall be done. Then she says this, scenes similar to those described in these words will take place. So brothers and sisters, this passage here, if you look at it closely, she's talking about the end of the world, and then she talks about Daniel 11. She's emphasizing Daniel 11. She says the prophecy in the 11th of Daniel has nearly reached its complete fulfillment. And then that's her first point. The reference of this passage is Daniel 11. And then she says, much of the history that's already taken place in Daniel 11 is repeated. Therefore, much of the history that's already taken place in the first 39 verses of Daniel 11 is prefiguring the last six verses of Daniel 11. So what she's emphasizing is if you're going to understand Daniel 11, you need to look for prophetic history within Daniel 11 to give you the pattern to understand those last six verses. But then more than that, she picks verses 30 to 36, puts them into the inspired record, and says scenes similar to those described in these words will take place. So brothers and sisters, when someone stands in front of you and gives you a presentation on what they think the last six verses of Daniel 11 are, then you know for sure that the history that they're identifying for you must parallel the history of verses 30 to 36. If it doesn't, there's a problem. There's a warning for that, because that's what Sister White is saying. Do you understand the logic of this passage, why it's so significant to these verses? She quotes verses 30 to 36 and says, scenes similar to those described in these words will take place. Now, you would not believe the many ways that people address this passage, but you don't have to. You could just take it at face value. What she's saying is, if you want to understand the flow of events for verses 40 to 45, then understand the flow of events for verses 30 to 36. Now, over the weekend, there's been a couple times where we've referred to Revelation 10, verse 4. And Revelation 10, verse 4 is where John hears seven thunders thunder, and he's told to seal up those things which the seven thunders thundered. And then we listen to Sister White's comments about it, and Sister White says the seven thunders symbolize two things. They symbolize the history of 1840 to 1844, but they also symbolize future events that will be disclosed in their orders, and this is in their order, and this is consistent with other passages and inspiration where we are clearly taught that the Millerite time period is repeated at the end of the world. But brothers and sisters, the Millerite time period, one of the things that was established and put together in the Millerite time period was this understanding of verses 30 to 36 of Daniel 11. And John was told to seal up that time period. So now, typically, I can make a point here, if you'll all cooperate. How many of you are prepared this evening to go out and give a Bible study to a non-Adventist on verses 30 to 36 of Daniel 11? Please raise your hands. One, two, and I know there's probably more, but that's where we're at. It's been sealed up to our understanding. And I haven't taken the time to show you the quotes, but we have them. Inspiration is clear that the way the Bible is sealed up is through traditions and fables. And as we've been wondering in the time period of Laodicea as Seventh-day Adventists, we've forgotten our foundations, accepted some false premises, taken on an attitude where it's not important to understand prophecy, and a multitude of other things. But here we are at the end of the world, where in Testimonies Volume 9, when Sister White is describing the end of the world, she points us to Daniel 11, and in this passage, when she's speaking about the end of the world, she's saying, if you want to understand Daniel 11, understand the history of verses 30 to 36. Now, brothers and sisters, there is a very easy reason to show you why this has some serious implications, and it's in verse 31 of Daniel 11. In verse 31 of Daniel 11, it says, "An arm shall stand on his part, and they shall pollute the sanctuary of strength, and shall take away the daily." Now, brothers and sisters, the pioneers had an understanding of the daily is that it was a satanic power, but here at the end of the world, our understanding of the daily is that it is a godly power. And the historical evidence that the pioneers used to identify what the daily is different than the history that's pointed to by those that teach that the daily is Christ's work in the heavenly sanctuary. And my point is this: if this sequence of events here in verses 30 to 36 is the pattern for the last six verses of Daniel 11, then how you understand the daily is very important. And I'm just saying the logic of it. This is a history that is a pattern for these verses. That's why you would not believe if you're gonna dive into the subject of the daily, which we're not doing here. Before you let people snowball you on the quotes in Ellen White concerning the controversy of the daily, make sure that you put them in context. The first thing you will hear from people is that the daily isn't something that we should be arguing about. It isn't something we should be pushing or discussing. You read those passages, and you know what you'll find in there over and over again? The daily is not a subject to be arguing about at this time. There's the qualifier in there in that history, and no one ever seems to emphasize that. And if you go back and read it over and over again, for some reason she's saying that in the early 1900 time period, the daily wasn't anything that we should be agitating. And there's a logical reason for it that I'm not giving, but all I'm saying is if someone throws that up at you, go back and read those passages. Many of them, she says, at this time. I can't go there. But what I want you to see is that these six verses are the pattern for Daniel 11. Now, recently, I have a brother that's interacting with me on my understanding, and one of his criticisms of me, which in my understanding and my teachings, is that I pick and choose which part of the pioneers that I want to agree with, while at the same time teaching that we have to defend the pioneer positions. And I can almost say that that he could have, he could maybe truly be making that argument, because I believe I could come across that way if I don't take the time to be very clear about my understanding. So I'm going to give you my understanding of the pioneers. Brothers and sisters, the pioneers put together the foundations of Adventism, but the pioneers were the climax of the Protestant Reformation. When the Millerites came into time, there were many truths that were not understood. Many, many truths, not just the sanctuary. And there, the process of establishing those foundations began before 1844, and they continued on long after 1844. So yes, there are time periods where you can go back on a subject and take a pioneer writing and show that the pioneer is wrong. What I'm saying is that the spirit of prophecy is very clear that we're to uphold the pioneers, and she's not being arbitrary about it. She's being reasonable. We're to go back and come to a correct understandings of what the pioneers established, but knowing that it was a development of truth. And these the brethren that we call the pioneers on these different subjects, when these subjects were being dealt with, they weren't agreeing with one another. They were studying them out. But it was a Josiah Litch coming to this conclusion, a Joseph Bate coming to this conclusion, and then Jay and Andrews putting them both together, and then everybody says amen. So if you just go back to Joseph Bate's statement or Crozier's statement, you can put a light on the pioneers as if they were in disunion. What I'm saying about the foundations of Adventism and upholding the pioneers is we have to go back and look at it intelligently. And then another criticism along that line that may be valid, and I'm forewarning you about, I don't take the time to try to share the development of these truths of the ones that I understand. I go back and see what I'm under conviction is an established pioneer position, and I give it to you as it is without saying it went through this process, this process, this process. So, once you start studying the pioneers, if you do, you will see that it was over a period of time that these truths were developed. I mean, for me, it went all the way at least into the 1880s. Into the 1880s, they were still dealing with the subject of the Godhead and righteousness by faith. And we've been told that there will be new light at the end of the world. So it's still a development of truth. Be forewarned, when I'm giving you how I understand the pioneer position, you need to test that out for yourself. And once you see if I'm giving you a fair representation of the pioneer position, you better make sure that you agree that the pioneers are in agreement with the Word of God. And I refer to Daniel and Revelation by Uriah Smith as the easiest point of reference for an overview of the pioneer position. Because I think it is, and because Sister White says every Seventh-day Adventist should have that book, should be giving it out to their neighbors, and she says it's God's helping hand, and therefore, even with the problems that that book has in it, and some of the problems are directly opposed to what we present. I mean, Uriah Smith was wrong on the King of the North. I mean, that's a big subject on the material we present, but still, show me one book in Adventism on Daniel and Revelation that's any better. There just isn't. But the history that he recorded there, brothers and sisters, it's history that is relevant. So, what I'm going to do here, so for those of you that haven't considered verses 30 to 36 in a while, I'm going to give you an overview of verses 30 to 36 of Daniel 11, and you can read the book Daniel and Revelation by Uriah Smith and confirm this for yourself, that this is a basic pioneer understanding. If you go back to verse 14, just to remind us, verse 14 is the time period of the very final Syrian kings, and verse 14 introduces the robbers of thy people. This is the first time pagan Rome's introduced into this history. And then in verse 16, you see pagan Rome begin its movements in conquering the world. And from this point on, after pagan Rome begins in Macedonia, but what's the first area of conquest in fulfillment of Daniel 8 verse 9 it has to conquer? Syria. And it conquers Syria, and Syria is where Babylon is. So when pagan Rome conquered Syria. Babylon was inside Syria. Syria was different back then. And the rule in Daniel 11 is the power that controls Babylon is who? The king of the north. So in verse 16, pagan Rome becomes the king of the north. And the subject of these verses on down through Daniel 11 is pagan Rome all the way until you get to verse 30 and 31. The transition takes over. In verse 30, it's still pagan Rome. It's in verse 3 says, "For ships of Chittim shall come against them." Where's Chittim in our common modern terminology? Cyprus. And who? What are the ships of Chittim that are coming against pagan Rome? It's the second trumpet. It's the Vandals. It's Genseric. So the trumpets begin to blow, and by the time you get to verse 30, you're in the second trumpet, which means that the Roman Empire is falling apart. It's being taken apart by these barbaric forces. And if you don't mind, maybe it's just me, but maybe it's the room. It seems kind of warm. So we're in the time period when Rome is being taken apart by the seven trumpets, and in verse 30 it says, "Ships of Chittim shall come against him, therefore he shall be grieved and return." Uriah Smith will tell you that this is identifying that pagan Rome no longer has the ability to just go out and be the master of the world. As it goes out to meet these Vandals, it doesn't prevail. And they return to Constantinople and have indignation against the Holy Covenant. And Uriah Smith points to a spiritual warfare that was taken up by pagan Rome during that time period to try to destroy the scriptures as the indignation against the Holy Covenant. This is what pagan Rome is doing. And so shall he do, pagan Rome. So shall pagan Rome do. He shall even return to Constantinople, which has been his capital now for a few hundred years. But here's the key sentence to this in the Pioneer Understanding. It says, pagan Rome will have intelligence with them that forsake the Holy Covenant. And the pioneers understood correctly that there is a power identified in Bible prophecy that would forsake the Holy Covenant in this time period. It's the church that was going to be the church of the falling away. It's the compromise that took place in Christianity. It's the papacy. It's the papal power is in history here. And the pioneers are saying that right here, pagan Rome begins to have intelligence with them that forsake the Holy Covenant. Intelligence, communications. And there is much history about that. That is what Bible prophecy is built around, is how pagan Rome placed the papacy on the throne of the earth. I mean, that's what this part of prophetic history is dealing with, and it's important. Why is it important? Why is it important to understand the dynamics on how pagan Rome placed papal Rome on the throne of the earth? Why does that matter? Because pagan Rome is a type of the United States. If you're going to understand what the United States is doing in the world today, if you're going to understand it from God's Word, then you need to understand the role that pagan Rome fulfilled as it placed the papacy on the throne of the earth. In fact, if you look closely at Daniel 11, verse 40, one of the things that takes place in verse 40 is the secret alliance between Ronald Reagan and the Vatican. If you've ever looked closely at that history during that time period, Ronald Reagan is paralleling the role of pagan Rome having communication with the papacy. It's a direct fulfillment. And if you go back into that history, if you remember the Time magazine called The Holy Alliance, written by Carl Bernstein, and then shortly thereafter, Carl Bernstein came out with a book called His Holiness, Pope John Paul II, and when that book was released, it was dealing with this history. He had an interview on Larry King Live. We have that interview. It's amazing what Carl Bernstein says, but he's very clear. When Ronald Reagan formed a secret alliance with the Vatican in order to bring down the Soviet Union, the King of the South, how did Ronald Reagan communicate on a regular basis with the papacy? How did he do it? The head of the Central Intelligence Agency was making regular trips back and forth to the papacy. No, he was the head of the Central Intelligence Agency. That's why when you see here in verse 30, it says that pagan Rome would have intelligence with them that forsake the Holy Covenant. Brothers and sisters, the United States had intelligence with the papacy here at the end through the Central Intelligence Agency. There's that kind of parallel in these verses as you go through. But in any case, the more important point to this history, probably to get it in your mind, once pagan Rome communicates with the papacy, from that point on, pagan Rome is no longer the subject of these verses. It changes right here. Now it's papal Rome. That's how the pioneers teach it. And this is correct, but this is probably not what we would get taught in a university in Adventism today. Maybe some places you would. But in verse 31, it says, an arm shall stand on his part. His part now is the papacy. The focus of this passage has just changed from pagan Rome to the papacy. Verse 31, now the subject is the papacy. And it says that there's military strength going to come to the aid of the papacy. Who supplied the military strength for the papacy? The seven European kings, one by one. Who was the first European king to give his military over to the papacy? Remember, there was pagan Rome disintegrated into 10 kingdoms, but three of those kingdoms need to be removed, and they were going to be removed by the military strength of these seven European kings. Who was the first? Clovis, king of France. That's why France is called the firstborn or eldest daughter of the Catholic Church. When did that happen? The year 496. And one by one, these seven European kings did the identical thing. They surrendered their military and economic support into the papacy, and they changed the legal profession of their religion in their nations from paganism to Catholicism. Historical fact. Pioneers noted it. Please get it in your mind, because that's the pioneer position, because the seventh European king was King Arthur in the year 508. And when he did the very same thing that Clovis did, then one of the things that happened in 508 is that all of those seven European kings had taken away their profession of paganism and replaced it with Catholicism, and the daily had been taken away. And now, in verse 31, it says arms, military support. These seven European kings are going to stand on the papacy's part, and they're going to pollute the sanctuary of strength. In Adventism today, or in the Protestant world, we would teach that this sanctuary of strength is the sanctuary in heaven that was polluted by the introduction of the Mass. But once again, this word sanctuary is not the word that Daniel employs for sanctuary in verses 13 and 14 of Daniel 8. When Daniel uses the word Hebrew word that's translated as sanctuary in verses 13 and 14 of Daniel 8, it's a Hebrew word that can only be God's sanctuary. But here, this is a different sanctuary, and as the pioneers understood it, the sanctuary of strength for pagan Rome was the city of Rome. That, and there's a large argument that they make about that historically and prophetically. Daniel 11, verse 24, if you weren't here the other day, look at verse 24 of Daniel 11. The very last phrase, verse 24, is dealing with pagan Rome. And it's saying that pagan Rome would rule the world for a time. A time is 360 years. In Daniel 8, verse 9, it says pagan Rome would have to conquer three geographical areas, the east, the south, the pleasant land. It conquered that third geographical area in 31 B.C. at the Battle of Actium. And 360 years later, in the year 330, Constantine moved the capital from Rome to Constantinople. And that divided the Roman Empire into two. But from that point on, Rome began to fall apart. The point is this. When pagan Rome had its capital in the city of Rome, That's when it was strong. That was its sanctuary of strength. And as soon as it moved out, everything fell apart. This is the logic, and in its correct logic, the prophetic logic of the pioneers. They polluted the sanctuary of the strength, in fact, because they moved it, and also because as the trumpets of Revelation 8 and 9 began to blow, and the pioneers correctly understood that the trumpets were the historical forces that God providentially used to bring the Roman Empire to a conclusion, when those trumpets began to blow, after the year 330, the first four trumpets were in Western Rome. And what was the focus of the warfare in Western Rome? It was the city of Rome. When Odoacer, Attila the Hun, Genseric, and Alaric, the first four trumpets, were attacking Western Rome, where they were trying to conquer, and they did conquer by the year 476. There was no more Romans that controlled the city of Rome. Their point of warfare was the city of Rome. Point being, the city of Rome during that time period was polluted. The sanctuary of strength was polluted through the warfare that took place, and also by the fact that Constantine chose Constantinople above Rome. That's both, pioneers would say both those things, primarily they emphasize the warfare. So, back to verse 31, the arms, pagan Rome's military strength stands up for the papacy. They pollute the city of Rome, the sanctuary of strength, and the warfare that's taking place during this time period. And they shall take away, and this word take away means remove, the daily. And according to the pioneers, the daily is paganism. And in this time period, from 496 to 508, the seven European kings removed the profession of paganism as their legal religion from every single one of those countries. And William Miller, there's a lot of historical evidences the pioneers point to identify the removal of paganism by 508. William Miller quotes Gibbons, I believe, but correct me if I'm wrong, Duane. It's one of the well-known historians. It may not be Gibbons, but he quotes one of the well-known historians that what was pagan Rome? What were those nations? They were pagans. What is the highest form of worship in paganism? Close. The highest form of worship. Human sacrifice. The highest form of worship is sun worship, but you're sacrificing people to the sun. That's the height of their worship. And the historians point out that by the year 508, paganism in Europe had been so subdued by Catholicism that there was no longer, after 508, any more human sacrifices that took place in the empire, the former Roman Empire. Paganism had been removed, both legally in the nations and in practice. Okay, so the pioneers have a very many strong arguments for their position of the daily, brothers and sisters. They have many strong arguments. But in any case, after they take away the daily in verse 31, it says they shall place the abomination that maketh desolate, which the pioneers correctly understood to be the papacy. It's pagan Rome that places the papacy on the throne of the earth. And if you're really going to get into that, you look at Revelation 13:2, where it says pagan Rome gave three things to the papacy: power, seat, and authority. It goes right into this verse. But in verse 31, after the papacy is placed on the throne of the earth, then verse 32 and onward begin to describe the persecution that takes place once the papacy is on the throne of the earth. So, when you come to verse 40 and onward in Daniel 11, what we're suggesting is that verses 40 through 43 are describing the three areas of conquest that modern Rome needs to subdue before it returns to its former position of power. The king of the south in verse 40 is atheism. And it came down in 1989 with the collapse of the Soviet Union. It came down through an alliance between the United States and the Vatican. That alliance has only grown stronger. It was started as a secret alliance. And now George Bush has said that he communicates two or three times a week with the Vatican to get counsel on his worldview. I mean, it's open now. It started secret. It's only grown since 1989. That was verse 40. That was the first area of conquest. The next area of conquest, the glorious land, the United States of America. After that, Egypt, with, and the countries of Egypt representing the entire world. When Egypt is conquered, the deadly wound is healed. And in verse 44, once the deadly wound is healed, you see a message that enrages the papacy, and it says he goes forth to utterly make destroy and make away many. The Hebrew here is identifying martyrdom. Just like verses 30 to 36, the first few verses are telling us how the papacy gets placed on the throne of the earth, and as soon as it's placed on the throne of the earth, persecution is portrayed. The history we're suggesting for the last six verses of Daniel 11 runs a perfect parallel with verses 30 to 36. And after Sister White quoted verses 30 to 36, she says, scenes similar to those described in these words will take place. And I only gave you a simple overview of verses 30 to 36, and of course a simple overview of verses 40 to 45, because I wanted to make the point about the significance of the daily and the abomination of desolation. I want to make one more point, and then we'll begin into the study that we'll stay with for the next, today and tomorrow for sure. We're dealing with one of the things I'm trying to deal with here. 10 minutes and then we stop for a break. Okay. One of the things I'm dealing with here is this message has been out in Adventism for a while, and there are some arguments against what we're suggesting these verses present. One of them we dealt with the other day, the glorious land. One of them we've already dealt with, but I want to go through some quotes and just nail it down, and it's this. Brothers and sisters, at the Sunday law in the United States, when the papacy conquers the glorious land, does the probation really close for Seventh-day Adventists? 10 minutes, let me do something extra to get us to the 10 minutes. Rather than, I don't want to start into these quotes and depart way in them and then take the break. I'd rather start right afterwards. Bear with me for just a second, please. There is a an interesting chiasm or chiastic structure. I'm not a theologian. I'm not sure I'm pronouncing that right. But it's throughout the Bible. One of the signatures of God is the way that he's built rhythms. I may not be explaining this perfectly, but he builds rhythms into his stories. I mean, he will begin a story at this level. As the narrative in the Bible continues, it'll take a step up, a step up, a step up, and it'll reach the climax of the presentation right here, and then it will step down, step down, step down to the exact point. And then when you compare the beginning with the ending, it's the same. That when you compare the second step with the step before the last step, it's the same subject, and it's just amazing. Can't be done. It's just, you know, only God could do it. It's divine. And if you're not familiar with those, they are there. Everyone acknowledges them. That this is not my own, you know, personal idea. It's a theological truth that the theologians deal with. But there is one of these structures that probably isn't a chiastic structure, because it's not so much. It's not in a passage of scripture. It's in prophetic history. You'll see what I mean in a minute. I call it a prophetic mirror. I'll explain that in a moment. In 1755, we had the great Lisbon, Portugal earthquake. This is a history going down to the end of the world. Sister White says prophecy is a timeline going down to the end of the world. These historical events on the timeline are waymarks, marks along the way. But in 1755, you have the great Lisbon, Portugal earthquake. 1793, French Revolution. 1798, papacy receives its deadly wound. 1840, the first angel's message comes into history. 1842, second angel's message comes into history. You have the midnight cry in here in July of 1844, and then on October 22nd, 1844, you have the third angel's message come into history. There's much to be said about this. I'm going to use this for a differently. Tell you these histories. If I have to write them up there, I only have 7 minutes left. I can deal with this later. Fill in the blanks for you on the histories if I need to. This is the Great Lisbon Portugal Earthquake, the French Revolution, Papacy's Deadly Wound, First Angel's Message, Second Angel's Message, Third Angel's Message with the Midnight Cry in between. Okay. I stand corrected. And the Midnight Cry joins the Second Angel's Message. That's the point I want to make. I want to make a point that the door closes on the Foolish Virgins on October 22nd, 1844. But on October 22nd, 1844, brothers and sisters, the Third Angel's Message came into history. The Adventists, Millerites didn't understand it necessarily at that time, but on October 22nd, 1844, the door was opened into the Most Holy Place, and by faith you could see into the sanctuary and see the Ark and see the Ten Commandments and see the Sabbath. And the Sabbath Sunday issue is the third angel's message. It was some time later before that crystallized in the minds of the Millerites, the Adventists of that time period, but historically, the third angel's message becomes present truth on October 22nd, 1844. Now, here's what I'm suggesting. The third angel's message is going to become present truth again at the end of the world, at the Sunday law. And there are events that take place prophetically at the Sunday law that have a direct parallel to these events, only they do it in a reverse order. That's why I call this the prophetic mirror. Right here's the mirror point. When the Sunday law comes into history here, once again, the third angel's message becomes present truth, and the door closes on Adventism. You follow the logic there? Because I'm going to go one step out for you. Sister White says what? When the third angel's message comes into history, the fourth angel's message joins the third angel's message, just as the midnight cry joined the second angel's message. And the midnight cry is a type of the loud cry, which is the fourth angel's message. Fourth angel's message joins the third. We're working backwards here. The second angel's message is where what? What happened on the second angel's message? Nope, that's the message. What happened at the second angel's message to fulfill it? The organized churches closed their doors against the Millerites, correct? And so what happened is that the Protestant churches closed their probation. See, in the Millerite time period, the Protestant churches closed their probation before the Millerites closed their probation. The Millerites' probation closes up here on October 22nd, 1844. But on 1842, the organized churches closed their doors. And what's the closing of the door in Bible prophecy represent? Close of probation. It's different at the end. It's reversed. Probation closes for Seventh-day Adventists first at the Sunday law. Then the fourth angel's message joins the third. And then Michael stands up, Daniel 12:1, and human probation closes for all mankind. Now, I'm saying that this parallels this. This parallels this. And as the Protestant churches close their door on probation, so Michael stands up. And the door of probation closes on the world. And then God pours out the seven last plagues. And the first angel's message was announcing the hour of God's investigative judgment. And it parallels the hour of God's executive judgment. Executive judgment is the seven last plagues, the punishment. The investigative judgment is the judgment. This parallels it. And then, in this time period of the seven last plague, Babylon falls truly and completely, fully. And this parallels 1798, when the deadly wound was delivered to the papacy, which is a type of the fall of Babylon. And in this time period, this is the time period of the seven last plagues, by the way. During this time period, the anarchy that takes place during this seven last time period, Sister White has used the French Revolution to describe. And how do the seven last plagues come to a conclusion? There is a great earthquake, which lines up with the great Lisbon, Portugal earthquake. So, what am I saying? I'm saying this. There's much to say about this. Much to say about this, brothers and sisters. This has a direct connection with the last six verses of Daniel 11. It has a direct connection with the third woe, the seventh trumpet in the book of Revelation. We're not dealing with that here tonight, but that is on the DVD. What we're saying here is this. In the book that we've been recommending here that we're out of, I called my wife today. We have three more. If someone needs that book, you can get it now, because the last we heard, as I said, is they are out of print, although I believe he has to print them again. This book, of course, you don't need this book for what I'm going to say, but this book is very good for several reasons. But one of the things he brings out here, brothers and sisters, is that the argument that took place right in here, immediately after the great disappointment, the big argument, the argument that separated the different Millerite people immediately after October 22nd, 1844, what was it? It was the closed door argument. What does it mean that the door closed on October 22nd, 1844? This is one of the issues where William Miller parted with James White and Hiram Edson. This issue was a big issue, the closed door issue. They've been teaching that the probation closed on October 22nd, 1844, and as soon as it didn't close, suddenly there was a variety of ideas, and it was the big controversy in those people that had been involved in the Millerite movement. So what am I saying? The first controversy, the first thing that has to be settled immediately after the third angel's message becomes present truth, has to do with the close of probation. That's the issue. So what I'm saying to you, in these 2 minutes before we take the break, is that here we are, we're approaching the Sunday law, where this is going to be paralleled, and one of the arguments about Daniel 11, verses 40 to 45, is about when and how probation closes. It's the same argument, only this time it's preceding the third angel's message coming into history. The other time it came right after. So it also... This argument we're going to share next is parallel. It's parallel in that history. Now if you pray with me, we'll take a short break. You might want to mention that.